He complained that the president forbade the army to investigate communism. Discussing the president's policy, he said, quote, is this bungling going to lead us into war while communism is left free to destroy us at home? He said, inter alia, that, quote, the one thing that is preventing the spread of communism in the Far East by the Russian government is a long line of the breasts of Japanese soldiers who are holding those communistic ways back. This statement was greeted with applause. He attacked Great Britain violently. He attacked the idea of bringing in Jewish refugees from Europe, ending as a footnote that he had many friends among the Jews. Well, probably not after that speech he did.
Now, remember here, what we're dealing with is a former key member of MacArthur's staff and a personal friend of MacArthur's who is plotting not only with an American fascist, but also with German espionage agents and diplomats to not only overthrow the government of the United States, but to murder the president of the United States. We're not able to read you the whole chapter here, but this comes in the middle of a chapter called The Plot to Kill the President. And what they are doing is basically actively conspiring against the government and proposing a fascist coup very similar to the one that the Morgans and DuPonts had attempted to institute in 1934. And again, people in this country are not accustomed to thinking about the United States as a country which has coups and attempted coups. And here is the second attempted military coup in the United States within a five-year period in the 30s. Continuing with American Swastika by Charles Higham, Mosley began to hint of the Dietherich plan at the end of his speech. And finally, gentlemen, remember that there is not a single red, not a single pink in the Army nor in the Navy. They stand clean. They stand supreme. Given the right orders from the Commander-in-Chief, they would meet every emergency. They can protect us individually as citizens in our local communities. They can protect us nationally as a government. Will the right orders come down under the present administration? Mosley gave another speech before a meeting on national defense at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia on March 28, 1939. Recall this about 6 months before World War II broke out. He said that the war now proposed, quote, is for the purpose of establishing Jewish hegemony throughout the world. We must recognize that fact. The communists have forced us to state it frankly, unquote. He referred to an address given recently in Atlanta to a Jewish assembly in which the speaker had said that the Jews were being organized to force the Roosevelt administration to compel Hitler to reinstate Jewish refugees in Germany to their former status, even at the cost of war. Mosley added that the speaker had been encouraged by the president and his first lady. Mosley denounced such a scheme and repeated that Kuhn and Loeb had financed the Russian Revolution, that Trotsky visited representatives in the United States, and that the Versailles Treaty was a mistake. The speech continued in like vein. Mosley referred to the visits of German Ambassador Hans Luther to his home and indicated that he concurred with Luther's statements that, quote, Hitler desires peace, but Germany must have elbow room in Europe for her development, and the powers must not interfere with Hitler as he reshapes Middle Europe to the advantage of the German people, unquote. He added that World War was part of the world plan of the communists and that Nazism was useful in the matter. Quote, the fascists and the Nazis in America have only one mission, as I understand, and that is to see to it that the communists shall not take possession of this nation. In fact, the finest type of Americanism can breed under their protection as they neutralize the efforts of the communists. And this hailing of the fascists as the answer to communism is probably the single greatest asset that the communists, that the fascists have. Basically, they have gained incomparable, basically, no one could compute how much mileage they have gained from their anti-communist stance.
Continuing on with Van Horn Mosley's speech. How then can we lick communism? First, by exterminating from the life of this nation all traces of the New Deal, the principal backers of communism. But that is not all. We must go to battle against the communists themselves. He accused 6 million Americans of being communist sympathizers, led by 80,000 members of the party. He said that they had plans to take over the principal cities, and that efforts must be made to prevent this revolution from taking place. He wanted a bill to allow the army a free hand in the matter. He clearly supported the idea of a military government, though he stopped short of suggesting that he himself could take charge of it. The general delivered a third speech in Springfield, Illinois, on April 26, 1939. In this address, he condemned Roosevelt outright as an arbiter of a divided world and charged England and France with building, quote, a steel ring around Germany in Europe. He hypocritically stated, in case someone should throw a brick at him, that he held no brief for, quote, Mr. Hitler, Mr. Mussolini, and the Mikado. But more honestly, he added, quote, we must admit that the success of the National Socialists in Germany saved that country from communism. He similarly approved the political actions of Mussolini and Emperor Hirohito. He stated that whereas there was no danger from Germany, Italy, or Japan, there was danger from labor leaders Harry Bridges and John L. Lewis. Harry Bridges, of course, was the local head of the Longshoremen's Union, I believe, up here in San Francisco. There was a peculiar irony in this, showing that the general was less than well informed. Lewis was involved in making deals with the Nazi collaborator oilman William Rhodes Davis at the time. He wound up the speech with an inflammatory charge that the Jews were whipping up war fever and that all of their attacks on Hitler were simply intended to bring the country into ruins. He reiterated Hitler doctrine by stating that it was necessary to adopt selective breeding, sterilization, and the elimination of the unfit, as well as all Jews from the American body politic. He did not specify where he proposed sending the Jewish population. Presumably, he had either had concentration camps in mind or supported the theory of George Ditheridge and others that the Jews should be shipped off to the island state of Madagascar, a suggestion also made by no less an authority than Adolf Eichmann. Yes, you will notice, of course, that this man, Van Horn Moseley, is not even approximating Nazi rhetoric. This man is literally giving out Nazi rhetoric, literally not only in the sense of the content, but the fact that it was actually handed to him right directly from a man who was getting it, largely getting his ideas from the Nazis themselves and directly having it handed to him.
Continuing now with Haim's account here. In May of 1939, Moseley, Dietrich, Campbell, and Gilbert, as some of his fellow fascist conspirators here, appeared before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. The chairman was Martin Dees of Texas, D-I-E-S. The board entertained such strange bedfellows as the ultra-liberal Jerry Voorhees of California and the notorious J. Parnell Thomas, who later became the scourge of the Hollywood Ten. Interrupting, of course, Jerry Voorhees was Richard Nixon's first opponent, and in Richard Nixon's first successful election campaign to Congress, he defeated Jerry Voorhees, who not only was sitting on the Dees Committee, which reviewed this, and again, this is an attempted fascist coup like the one in 34, Jerry Voorhees also was leading the fight on the floor of Congress to break up the IG Farben Chemical Company in Germany. Of course, Dick Nixon, and we've talked about his Nazi connections in the past, put Jerry Voorhees out of business. Continuing, the committee heard the witnesses out and scored them chiefly on anti-Semitism, leaving their anti-communist remarks aside. Reference was made to such predictions by Dietrich in print as, quote, the gutters will soon run with the blood of Jews, unquote. Moseley was questioned directly on the matter of the current controversy about admitting children of Jewish families from Germany as refugees. Moseley replied, quote, I don't think the Jews expect to get the Congress of the United States to make any definite changes in the immigration laws. They are closed, I hope, for all time, unquote. The effect of the Dees Committee hearing and its attendant publicity was that it was difficult for Campbell, Gilbert, and Dietrich to operate in the matter of the proposed coup d'etat. The banner of intended revolution passed into the hands of the leaders of the Christian Front movement, with Father Charles Coughlin presiding behind the scenes. Charles Coughlin, by the way, was a fiercely anti-Semitic fascist priest who headed this organization called the Christian Front. And essentially, it preceded Adolf Hitler and was very much opposed to Roosevelt, Jews, and all kinds of things.
And it should be mentioned that people these days are not familiar with. Charles Coughlin was probably more than the Jerry Falwell of his day. He had a huge radio following, just gigantic. And they also had a newspaper that they published that was had a subscription well up into the millions. And to this day, I heard somebody the other day, or I saw somebody write in to protest in a magazine article where Father Coughlin was being referred to as a reactionary pro-fascist priest to claim that he was really a man of God. So 40 years after the fact, people are still defending this man who was probably one of the most influential people of his day, and certainly among the most influential fascists of his day.
Yeah, and he was, for the record, a doctrinaire fascist. And it's worth noting, I think Niptuck made a good point in referring to Jerry Falwell, that this sort of strident, ultra-reactionary political Christianity is not a new phenomenon in the United States. A lot of people seem to think that the Christian right is relatively new. It's not new at all, and it was flourishing with much the same kinds of rhetoric and many of the same kinds of names of the organizations in this period of time, in the late 30s. Continuing with Haim's account, the Christian Front movement, which had developed simultaneously with the German-American Bund, was in every way more insidious and powerful. Whereas the Bund after 1938 operated without much support from the German government, the Christian Front was indirectly encouraged by Himmler, Hess, and Ernst Wilhelm Bolle, B-O-H-L-E. Whereas the Bund had a substantial percentage of Irish Catholic membership, the Christian Front was almost entirely Irish-American. In view of the careful approach toward Hitler by Pope Pius XII on his assumption of the papacy in 1939, it is not surprising that the scores of thousands of Christian Front members felt not entirely out of order in pursuing their activities. The movement was divided up into units of 20 to 25 men each, under Coughlin's specific direction, a device resembling that to be found in the SS. The Front took over from Dietrich in 1940, absorbing his American Nationalist Federation in a consuming alliance of purpose. The difference was that whereas Dietrich's ANF was made up largely of the lunatic fringe and the blue-collar class of unemployed, the Christian Front had in its membership an extraordinary number of police, members of the National Guard, White Russians, and expatriate Irish Republican Army militia. What had seemed a mere pipe dream in the minds of the Bund or the trio supporting Mosley for president now became something approaching a possible political putsch movement. A coup d'etat at this stage was not entirely outside the bounds of possibility, and once again, General Mosley was first choice as the nation's leader. Yet the problem now was that the Christian Front became too overt in its activities as the Bund had. Its members were constantly beating up Jews in subways and on buses, on street corners and in parks, while at the same time forcibly distributing social justice. They openly denounced the president under the protection of the free speech regulations they would have been the first to abolish under the new regime. In 1940, J. Edgar Hoover became seriously concerned when he got wind of the formation of a group of extremist Christian fronters that called itself the Sporting Club. This group was determined to rally 300,000 Irish-American members in the police and the National Guard to seize the White House and place General Mosley in the Oval Office. So what we have here basically is a group of domestic fascists conspiring with spies and diplomatic representatives from Nazi Germany and collaborating actively with them to once again stage a fascist coup in the United States, this 5 years after the Morgan, DuPont, MacArthur attempt that they wanted to get General Butler to head. And essentially we have the same, some of the same groups, and of course remember the Morgan group's role in Nazi Germany, and remember their connections through Stotesbury to General MacArthur, and Mosley, a key member of MacArthur's staff and a close personal friend, and he basically is involved in an incipient fascist coup against the United States.
Okay, now at this point they're talking about a trial in which Van Horn Mosley is being questioned about the plot to overthrow the government, and the Rogge, R-O-G-G-E, that they're referring to is a man by the name of O. John Rogge.
He, by the way, is the guy who was he was a federal prosecutor prosecuting these people for the proposed fascist coup.
Okay, reading again from American Swastika. On July 25th, after 14 weeks, Rogge started in on General Van Horn Mosley and the plot to overthrow the government. Despite a barrage of screams, yells, and beating of fists on tables, he pressed on, producing letters by William Dudley Pelley to Mosley stating such things as, quote, "The weapons are in our hands to hurl this overseas crowd of subversionists out of our country. I am carrying in my head, my dear general, information of so colossal a character that I feel it should be shared by at least four other men besides myself, namely Henry Ford, Colonel Lindbergh, Senator Wheeler," that's Senator Burton K. Wheeler, who was the biggest wheel in the isolationist movement in the United States, "and yourself. I am already in contact with Mr. Ford and am leaving for Detroit in the morning to see him again," unquote. Ford naturally denied any knowledge of this matter, and so did Mosley. Okay, skipping along. Now they're talking again about Charles Coughlin, and Father Coughlin, of course, printing the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I mentioned earlier in the broadcast was originally a forgery by the Okhrana, which is the White Russian secret police, the Tsarist secret police, and has later come to be part of the lexicon of fascism, and the Nazis all use it as being a given that these are the protocols of how the Jews are going to take over the world, and that it's passed on secretly from Jew to Jew, and this is the unknown secret plan of the Jews for the world. Anyway, they're talking about Father Coughlin having reprinted the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in Social Justice, which is the newspaper that his group, the Fronters, handed out. Anyway, Coughlin circulated the Protocols through the publishing house owned by William Dudley Pelley, leader of the Gestapo-like Silvershirts, who had served with the Japanese in Siberia in 1918 when he became convinced that Jews were financing the Russian Revolution.
Now, of course, William Dudley Pelley and his Silvershirts organization harkens back to the article from the New York Times of June 11th, 1983 that Niptuck was reading you on that tape segment, that we played earlier in the broadcast. The William Dudley Pelley's Silvershirts organization served as the inspiration and the, I guess you could say, the fascist jumping off point for the founders, the founder of the Oregon-based, of the Posse Comitatus. And that is one of the groups subsumed under the umbrella organization of the Aryan Nation. So once again, William Dudley Pelley here is involved with Van Horn Moseley and German intelligence and diplomatic representatives in putting together this proposed fascist coup. Now, let's basically take another look here at William Dudley Pelley and some of his connections. Now, recall that we looked at Dietrich and Van Horn Moseley's contacts with von Gienath and a man named Luther, Hans Luther, both German spies and diplomats. William Dudley Pelley as well was actively cooperating with Nazi espionage prior to and during World War II. I'd like to read you a short section now from a book called Sabotage, The Secret War Against America. That was co-authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N. Copyrighted 1942, published in hardcover by Harper and Brothers Publishers. And of William Dudley Pelley and his silver shirts and their contacts with the German Weltdienst, or World Service, part of its overseas espionage organization, Sayers and Kahn write as follows. Keeping the American psychological saboteurs constantly supplied with anti-Semitic propaganda and with other disruptive material were two official German organizations, Weltdienst, World Service, which had its headquarters at Dobsterter Straße 4, Erfurt, Germany, and Deutscher Fichtebund, or the German Fighter Society, located in Hamburg, Germany. From these two sources emanated vast numbers of anti-democratic pamphlets and bulletins containing propaganda devised to incite race hatred. This propaganda material, which for the convenience of its recipients throughout the world was printed in a dozen languages, reached the United States public through such homespun publications as Father Charles E. Coughlin's Social Justice of Royal Oak, Michigan, William Dudley Pelley's Liberator of Asheville, North Carolina, Reverend Gerald Winrod's Defender of Wichita, Kansas, William Kulgren's Beacon Light of Atascadero, California, and many other pro-Axis anti-Semitic newspapers, magazines, and newsletters. So here, William Dudley Pelley is actually getting some of his anti-Semitic propaganda from Third Reich espionage services. And again, the Silver Shirts were the jumping off point, the originating point for the founder of the Posse Comitatus, one of these groups which we're looking at under the umbrella organization of the Aryan Nations. And recall, William Dudley Pelley conspiring with MacArthur's staff member and friend Moseley to overthrow the government of the United States in partnership with Nazi Germany.
And so we're going to hear a little bit more about that from William Manchester's book, American Caesar. This is a Dell book, copyright 1978. As early as January 13th, and this is January 13th, if I think about what, 1942, it probably would
January
be.
January 13th of 43.
43,
right.
Okay, that's right, because Eisenhower is landing in North Africa at this point. As early as January 13th, Joseph Medill Patterson's New York Daily News had clamored for MacArthur's, quote, rescue and a powerful post in Washington for him. Patterson was soon joined by his sister, Sissy, in the Washington Times-Herald, by his cousin, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, in the Chicago Tribune, and by William Randolph Hearst and Frank Gannett in their newspaper chains. I should just mention that in previous shows, we've talked about Robert R. McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, who was probably the most isolationist editor of his time, a rabid hater of Roosevelt and the Roosevelts in general. And a man who, among other things, broke the secret war plans of the United States as a front-page story, largely to embarrass the Roosevelts, and God only knows what kind of effect it had on America's ability to fight war in Europe. But McCormick apparently did it purely out of dislike for Roosevelt and his feeling that Roosevelt was trying to drag the United States into an unnecessary war when it should be fighting the communists, or at least letting the Nazis destroy the communists and order Europe correctly. Anyway, so here's this group of editors all getting together to clamor for MacArthur to be brought back to Washington and installed in an important post. Among MacArthur's most vocal supporters were Gerald L. K. Smith, William Dudley Pelley, and Father Charles E. Coughlin, who accused the administration of planning to throw him, quote, to the dogs. George Van Horn Moseley, an old friend of both MacArthur and Eisenhower, late in life, in parentheses, it says, Ike described him as a, quote, brilliant and dynamic officer who was, quote, always delving into new ideas, which is...
The last sentence I don't think you could argue with.
That's an interesting way to put it, I was going to say. Anyway, George Van Horn Moseley wrote the general on November 10, 1942, that, quote, subversives were terrified by MacArthur's popularity. Moseley prophesied that the American people, outraged by the, quote, mongrelization of the country by... quote, low-bred immigrants, blacks, New Dealers, and Jews, would overthrow the government and recall the general as dictator. He predicted, Moseley, quote, you would be damned for the moment, but in the end you would make for yourself a place in history unequaled except by our first president himself, unquote. So, it's very difficult to make the point that MacArthur was not perfectly aware of the kinds of people that he surrounded himself with when Van Horn Moseley is writing to him telling him that the mongrels and the low-bred immigrants are trying to take over the country and MacArthur should come back and make himself dictator and become the second George Washington. It would require a more than normal obtuseness to miss the implications there.
And recall that in response to this letter, in the phrase from Robert Smith, MacArthur said it contained, quote, much food for thought, unquote, which is perhaps also true, but not the statement one would have hoped from the chief of staff, a former chief of staff of the Army. Anyway, note here that basically Douglas MacArthur, in-law of the Morgan Group, and specifically son-in-law, at least with his first wife, of Edward Stotesbury, who was a Morgan associate and a fascist financier himself, that MacArthur is being basically anointed by a number of prominent reactionary newspaper editors, as well as some doctrinaire fascists like William Dudley Pelley and Coughlin that we've looked at, also fellow Gerald L. K. Smith that we're going to look at in a second. He's basically being hailed as the savior of the country from the New Deal, and there is considerable pressure being exerted here right in the middle of World War II for having MacArthur brought back to the United States and installed in Washington. Now, we're going to review some of this material in our next broadcast before we go back to this, but we're going to focus on, we're going to come back to this mid-war attempt at bringing MacArthur home in our next broadcast. It's worth noting here, though, that, again, MacArthur was the first choice of the Morgan Group to head up the fascist coup in 1934. His top aide, close friend, and advisor, Moseley, was actively conspiring with the Nazis to overthrow the Roosevelt government in 1939, William Dudley Pelley conspiring with him. And here we find William Dudley Pelley, Charles Coughlin, who also worked with Van Horn Moseley to overthrow Roosevelt, and a guy named Gerald L. K. Smith, working in the middle of World War II to bring Roosevelt, or to bring MacArthur home as an answer to Roosevelt. Now, this fellow Gerald L. K. Smith is another prominent American fascist, and he was very, very noted for publishing a publication called The Cross and the Flag, which was one of the best distributed and one of the best known, most widely known, of all of the fascist publications in that time. And it's worth noting that The Cross and the Flag continued into publication long after the end of World War II. So this guy was in business in the 50s. Reading again from American Swastika, and again, this is Gerald L. K. Smith, the fellow who was lending his support to MacArthur, and it's worth noting here that Gerald L. K. Smith's fascist The Cross and the Flag was mailed out under the congressional franking privileges of a number of different senators and congressmen who backed his ideas. So Gerald L. K. Smith was a man who was able to requisition support from some influential quarters. Reading now from American Swastika. Joseph P. Camp's many publications included Native Nazi, a violent attack on Maloney in the Department of Justice. Gerald L. K. Smith's fascistic The Cross and the Flag actually started publication 3 months after Pearl Harbor with endorsement from Senators Reynolds and Nye, who praised it to the skies in public. Backed by various industrialists, Smith rallied a staggering 1 million people to support the idea of a negotiated peace with Hitler and came close to winning a seat in the Senate from Michigan in spite of his anti-American stance. His favorite phrase was, "When chaos comes, I'll be the leader," unquote. Yet another fundamentalist minister, Gerald B. Winrod of Wichita, Kansas, published The Defender beginning in 1942, which attacked Jews as the Antichrist. Of course, that's the same line as the Aryan Nations. It was owned partly by Senator Reynolds and with support by Gerald L. K. Smith.
All right, reading a little bit more about Gerald L. K. Smith and the kind of journalism that the man was involved with. This is another section from American Swastika here, and it reads as follows. Immediately after World War II, Nazi activism in America continued apace. Such fascists as Merwin K. Hart of the Constitutional Educational League and Gerald L. K. Smith proceeded without interruption in their various activities. In May 1951, Smith's The Cross and the Flag, which had not been interrupted by the inconvenient advent of World War II, reproduced an article from an early 1915 issue of the United States Military Academy Howitzer Yearbook, which gave a description of Dwight D. Eisenhower as a Jew. The article stated that Eisenhower was a, quote, Swedish kike, and otherwise vilified him in the most scabrous manner. Harry S. Truman was also branded a Jew. His middle name became Solomon. Skipping on down. On the other hand, Gerald L. K. Smith and several other fascists were keenly in support of, guess who, General Douglas MacArthur, and fought for his nomination for president in 1952. Students of history may recall that MacArthur was mentioned by the 1934 conspirators who sought to overthrow the government as a possible alternative to General Smedley D. Butler of the Marines as president. MacArthur did not consent to any such nomination for a so-called third party, but his name was still used on the tickets. Vivian Kellams, who, it will be recalled, had corresponded through World War II with the Nazi agent Count von Seidlitz in Buenos Aires and had fought personal income tax, was named as vice president by the so-called Constitution Party. Another nominee was California State Senator Jack Tenney. After Eisenhower's inauguration, the Constitution Party kept up its attack. Senator McCarthy had its full endorsement during the Fort Monmouth scandal when he used, quote, evidence of a communist spy ring at the fort, quote, in order to flush it free of Jews.
Okay, now, take particular note here of Gerald L. K. Smith and other domestic fascists' efforts to get MacArthur to run for president. MacArthur himself made an abortive try for the 1952 Republican nomination, which was referred to in Robert Smith's MacArthur in Korea. Worth noting here that a number of fascist parties tried to get MacArthur, in fact, did place MacArthur's name in nomination as a third-party candidate. Now, the discussion in American Swastika was of Gerald L. K. Smith's efforts in that direction. I'd like to read you a short section from an article, a short section from the Los Angeles Times of September 12, 1952, an article sent to us by a listener. This is an AP story, Dateline Olympia, Washington, headline, MacArthur's name filed as candidate. The name of General Douglas MacArthur was filed with the Secretary of State's office here yesterday as the presidential nominee of the Christian Nationalist Party. His running mate was listed as State Senator Jack B. Tenney of Los Angeles. The names were filed by Dr. Wesley Swift of Los Angeles, a member of the party's central committee. Well, now, recalling back to the beginning of our broadcast, Dr. Wesley Swift was the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ Christians, whose military wing, the Christian Defense League, was basically taken over after Swift's death by Reverend Richard Butler. And Butler, of course, is the head of the Aryan Nations. And again, that's sort of an umbrella group for the Christian Defense League, Posse Comitatus, and a number of different intersecting organizations, which we're going to be looking at for several weeks, or several broadcasts of Radio Free America. Now, interestingly enough, Richard Butler, basically, the head of the Aryan Nations, got his start as a racist while serving in the military in the Pacific Theater. Now, he was stationed in India, so I don't believe he actually would have been under MacArthur's command. It's still worth noting, though, that while in the military was where Butler got his start as a racist and that he was in the same theater of operations as MacArthur. Again, not conclusive, but just an interesting coincidence in light of the many, many intersections between a lot of these seemingly disparate elements here. Returning again to the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, January 27th, 1985. Reading of this is an article toward a church built on hate. Butler looks like a kindly grandfather with a full head of gray hair and deeply lined cheeks. A former Lockheed Aeronautics engineer in Burbank, we're going to come to the aerospace connections in our next broadcast, he became a racist during World War II in India when he was a U.S. Army captain on loan to the Royal Indian Air Force. I had a servant named Jeremy, Butler recalls. He asked me why we were fighting our brethren in Europe. I couldn't answer him. He said he was an Aryan, too, and I laughed. Jerami said, I represent the pollution of the race. I'm proud I have some of your blood flowing in my veins. It bothered me that a servant knew more about my ancestry than I did, so I began what became a lifelong study. Through the 1960s, Butler was a close associate of Dr. Wesley A. Swift, a prominent racist minister who operated out of Lancaster. Butler and his wife Betty came to Idaho, the last Aryan bastion, in 1973 to establish the Aryan Nation. So again, not conclusive, but interesting here as well. Now, we're going to be, again, following this whole train of events on into the 50s later, and sort of think about this broadcast as the setting of the table. We're going to serve dinner in the next time. So if it's not in the next broadcast, the next program in this series, so if it's not altogether clear where this is going, be patient. Hopefully it will by the time we're finished.
All right. And one last article before we go to some tape segments here. And this article is also from American Swastika by Charles Higham. The organizations, meaning the America First organization, Gerald L. K. Smith's organizations, all these, the Christian Front, the organizations proliferated in the 1950s to a degree almost inconceivable even in the careless rapture of the early 1940s. There was the Congress of Freedom, not to be confused with the more intellectually respectable CIA-connected Congress for Cultural Freedom, and the aggressive group headed by Dan Smoot of Dallas, a self-styled authority on every aspect of communism, whose favorite targets were Ed Murrow, Jack Kennedy, and, needless to say, Eleanor Roosevelt. There was H.L. Hunt, worth approximately $3 billion, with an income of $50 million a year, whose Lifeline Foundation received a postal subsidy and a tax exemption as a religious organization. Lifeline had 300 radio stations and 55 television stations emitting a constant stream of Nazified propaganda in collaboration with Dan Smoot, Merwin K. Hart, and Gerald L. K. Smith. The John Birch Society climbed on the bandwagon.
Okay, we're going to talk about the John Birch Society in our next broadcast, and we're going to sort of link the John Birch Society in with all of these groups and show you how it intersects with them and how it sort of grew out of the same kind of a complex. Now, remember the things that we've been looking at on this broadcast. We began by taking a look at the Aryan Nations, which is an umbrella group, and some of the people involved in it, and then we began following the roots of some of these people. We took a look at the head of the Christian Defense League, William Potter Gale, who boasted proudly that he had served on MacArthur's staff in the Philippines during the war. After that, we took a look at the founder of the Posse Comitatus, who basically goes back to the silver shirts of William Dudley Pelley. Following that, we took a look at how the Morgan Industrial Group had actively promoted fascism on both sides of the Atlantic, and Douglas MacArthur's connections to the Morgan Group, and in particular, MacArthur's proposed participation in a military coup in the United States in 1934. We also looked at the numerous fascists that MacArthur had allowed to gather around him. General Whitney, a screaming anti-Semite. General George Van Horn Mosley, an outright traitor to his country who had conspired actively with the Nazis and domestic fascists to overthrow the government about 5 years after the proposed coup involving MacArthur or Smedley Butler. And we also looked at General Willoughby, a German-born fascist, an admirer of Francisco Franco, who became MacArthur's intelligence chief. We looked at Andres Soriano, Francisco Franco's representative in the Philippines, who became a colonel on MacArthur's staff and one of MacArthur's most important representatives in that part of the world. We also took a look at the participation of a number of different domestic fascists, William Pelley, Charles Coughlin, Gerald L.K. Smith, with Van Horn Mosley, and saw how many of these same people then began throwing their support to General Douglas MacArthur as President of the United States. And we saw that attempts to nominate MacArthur as president continued on a third-party candidate, and that some of the people involved are some of the same people we see going back to the Aryan Nations, like Reverend Wesley Smith, Swift.
Now, again, one looks at the Aryan Nations and the groups of today, and many people are tempted to say that these are small groups of fringe lunatics, and undoubtedly they are fringe lunatics, and undoubtedly in their individual status, they may also be small groups. But remember, we've been looking tonight at, two good examples. One, for instance, of the Christian Front, Father Coughlin's Christian Front, which at one time had a membership in the hundreds of thousands made up largely, or to a large extent, of policemen and National Guardsmen. Indeed, anybody out there who's read William Turner's Power on the Right will recall the what he said was the absolute shocking amount of people in the police services and the National Guard who were also John Birch Society members. So we're not talking about small groups. Second of all, we're also talking about a direct connection between the most powerful military man in the United States and people who think that Jesus Christ was an Anglo-Saxon. So we are not talking about small and uninfluential fringe loonies here. We're talking about serious, big-deal Mondo crazies with connections into high seats of government. And we've talked, anybody who's been hanging around for the last few years has noticed the people cropping up in the Reagan administration claiming things like that the handicapped must have wanted to be handicapped, otherwise they wouldn't be, and claiming that people like Daryl Gates in Los Angeles, the police chief down there, claiming that black people don't react like human beings do, and that's why so many of them die when the officers put chokeholds on them. And we've seen Ed Meese talking about how there aren't really hungry people in America. And can you really feel so secure saying that the Aryan Nations and Richard Butler's people are so far off the mainstream in view of some of the things that we've just been talking about? Well, y'all think about it a little bit. We're going to take a short musical break for a few moments, Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, and then we're going to be back with the last segment of information, mostly on tape at this point, and talking about the rise of the FEMA in Germany, and hopefully, again, making some of those points even more clear to you in a more direct manner. And then, time permitting, we will take some phone calls. So don't go away. This is Nip Tuck, and you are listening to Radio Free Cast. It makes it almost sound like the movie, the archive broadcast. But that's what it is, an archive broadcast. And we're going to be playing a couple of tape segments to finish these things off for you. We want to mention that, unfortunately, due to the length of the broadcast, and of course, Dave and I don't possibly have a chance to actually do the broadcast before we get on the air to find out exactly how long it's going to be. So these are always kind of guesswork things. And it looks like we are not going to have time for phone calls. But Dave will be able to take phone calls on Sunday on One Step Beyond. I will be out of town. And at that point, anybody who has any questions can ask. Otherwise, we'll try and be sure and leave some time in the two other archive broadcasts on this topic. And you can always go back and refresh your memory with your tapes, hopefully, and then save your questions up for the other archive broadcasts.
Yeah, we can. I think if we plan on two more on this series, I think we can definitely get phone calls in on the next. In fact, if we do the connections of the Aryan Nations to this country's political assassinations and the John Birch Society next week, and then our next show, next week, right?
You keep
next
saying show. That, you scare me.
Next week, yeah, I keep, you know, giving Nip the impression we're going to do this every week here. It's tiring enough once a month. But, yeah, we'll have time for phone calls. So don't despair. I'll tell you what, on Sunday night, Nip Tuck is not going to be here. He's other appointments. If you like, I was going to play the Mae Brussel tape during the last hour of the normal One Step Beyond slot because it was only tape... God, I can't remember what the last tape was. It was 7:08, I think. It was only played once due to the fact that normally it's aired on Thursday evenings. If you like, though, during the One Step Beyond show on Sundays, we can have a little, do what we've done before, have a little poll. I have our phone screener record your desires, and if you like, we could take phone calls for that last hour if enough people feel that they listened to the Mae, you know, if enough people caught the Mae Brussel broadcast Sunday morning, then we could go ahead and take phone calls that last hour. So what we'll do on Sunday is we'll give you a chance to determine the broadcast yourself. We'll take a little poll while during the first 2 hours of the broadcast while we're sitting up here and yakety yakking. And if you like, we can take calls for the last hour since we didn't get the chance to do that this evening, or we can play the Mae Brussel tape again, depending on what you want to do.
Okay, and while we're at it, let me give a brief plug for our phone screener, Jim, whose last name, in the interest of not having guys in funny, weird uniforms showing up at his door at 4 o'clock in the morning with big sticks and burning crosses, we will not give at this point. But anyway, Jim is not only has been a wonderful phone screener for us, but he has put up with just endless adversity, like tonight when we get on the phone to him at about 9:15 and tell him, hey, we need you up here at 10 o'clock. And he gets up here, and there's nothing for him to do because we have run over time again. And we've done this to him a couple of times, and Jim is truly a noble individual whose merits and praises cannot be spoken of enough.
He also has been providing us with some good information, too. He's turning into a researcher.
That's right. That's right. And he's also a good person just for that reason to have on the phones. Answering people's calls because he knows what you're talking about. He's not just somebody sitting here answering phones to earn some credits for the college class, although he certainly deserves those too. But anyway, so a plug for Jim, who has just done a wonderful job for a long time now. Jim has been our phone screener for...
He's added, it may seem silly. I mean, we're not trying to polish the apple, but having a competent phone screener is, and an experienced film screener is a big asset when we're doing the show, and Jim is by far, in a way, the best that's come around, and he's been a big, big asset to the broadcast.
That's right. So, big fella, no paycheck this month, but that's what we could do for you. So.
Right. Anyway.
Okay, back to serious Radio Free America business here in terms of what's going to go on the air next, and we are going to be airing a broadcast on the FEMA, which we mentioned earlier, and Dave is going to explain to you very briefly what that's about and what broadcast this is from.
Right. Basically, we're going to broadcast a couple, right now we're going to play, I should say, a couple of hard rain shows. Regular listeners will have heard these before. This is by way of documenting the origins of the Nazi Party in Germany and how it grew out of the military and how it came to power. Now, if it is not totally clear how the information we've presented this evening is going to coordinate with this. Remember the many general staff connections to MacArthur and the many general staff connections between Douglas MacArthur and these fascist groups we've been talking about. And remember that MacArthur's connections to the Morgan Group and, of course, the Morgan Group's participation in Nazi Germany. And in particular, these broadcasts, these two hard rain shows, will sort of serve as the transition for the next program in our Aryan Nations series. In fact, I think probably in order to pick up the thread of these broadcasts, maybe we'll have the second of these two shows start off our next program, because the origins of the John Birch Society are going to be very important to scrutinize in comparison with the origins of the Nazi Party. But this information will reflect certainly on the things we've talked about tonight. And remember the MacArthur staff connections here. That's very important with the Aryan Nations. And it'll be even more relevant, I think, to sort of set the table for our discussion of the John Birch Society and how all of these organizations will intersect with John Birch. So,
okay.
Very important to remember.
And once again, Dave, you want to mention the name of the date of this tape, if you...
I don't even know. At this point in the Hard Rain production process, I wasn't dating them. This was simply the sixth program in an ongoing series about the Ku Klux Klan. So this, folks, is
out of the golden age of Hard Rain when they weren't even dating them at that point.
Right. Well, it's a fairly recent broadcast, but I was just doing them by series at this point. But this is about, little under a year old.
Okay, very good. And once again, let me just personally apologize for the lead digits there. I punched up a bunch of buttons when we were trying to get back on the air again. I kind of panicked. As a result, we're going to skip a little bit over Dave's introduction, but it is Hard Rain, and it is, of course, Dave on tape, and he'll be just starting into the rap, so if you miss a teeny little bit of it, it's my fault, and you'll catch up real quickly, because he'll give you a moment before he gets into the serious information. So once again, this is from a Hard Rain series on the FEMA, and you are listening to Radio Free America with Dave Emery and Nip Tuck.
We're going to be continuing with a series of programs we've been doing about the Ku Klux Klan. And in this broadcast, and actually the next two broadcasts at least, we're going to be digressing a little bit from the subject of the Ku Klux Klan per se. And what we're going to be doing is taking a look at the origins of the Nazi Party in Germany. And we're going to be doing that for the purpose of taking a look at some rather ominous structural similarities between the present-day Klan, and in particular the U.S. government agents operating within that Klan in principal leadership roles, and the formation of the German Nazi Party in the 1920s.